Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The inspirational teacher movie is a cliche in Hollywood. To Sir with Love, Stand and Deliver, Lean on Me, Mr. Holland's Opus, Dead Poets Society. We accept that great teachers can change our children's lives, our lives. Do we believe they can fix our schools? Teacher, teacher, can you teach me? Can you tell me all I need to know? Thousands of teachers think kids need fewer textbooks and stronger school principals. But many lawmakers say we just need better teachers. Who's right? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, March 4th, and the takeaway is, you know, I actually can't entirely figure out how to get my kid to do what I want at home. It's not really a surprise to figure out that we have so much trouble figuring out how to get them to do better in school.
Well, yeah, ask the teachers. Let's start there.
You know, maybe. Okay,
there you go. I love that. Let's get right to the top stories we're watching this morning. New economic numbers out last hour show first-time jobless claims fell sharply last week, but overall, the total number of people receiving unemployment benefits of any kind rose slightly to 11.5 million. President Obama says he can see the finish line, and he's pushing Democrats to do whatever it takes to get health care reform done.
I believe the United States Congress owes the American people a final vote on health care reform.
It would be a majority rules vote and would only come after the House adopts the Senate version of the bill. In a related story, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is calling insurance company leaders into the White House this morning to ask them about ballooning premiums.
I am bringing in five insurance executives this morning to find out what in the world is going on. How can you file $12 billion worth of profits in 2009 and turn around and have jaw-dropping increases?
Sebelius was speaking on CBS News this morning.
Meanwhile, the House is expected to pass a jobs bill later today that includes tax breaks for companies that hire unemployed workers and increases highway funding as well. In Germany, four men have been convicted in a foiled plot to attack U.S. targets there. The four, two from Turkey and two from Germany, their converts to Islam, have been given prison sentences of up to 12 years. A court found they'd plotted bombing attacks against U.S. citizens and facilities, including a U.S. Air Force base. Here at home, the superintendent who fired every teacher at a Rhode Island high school says she's willing to negotiate their return. That comes after the teachers' union promised to support reforms. And in the largest ever survey of teachers in this country, thousands answered questions on how to fix schools. We're joined now by Kate DeSetti. She's been teaching high school English for 10 years in Fresno, California. She was also one of the final readers of the Gates Foundation National Survey on Teachers that was released yesterday. Kate, the thing that strikes me is there are 6.2 million teachers in the U.S., so 40,000 is a relatively small fraction of all of the teachers. Why is it we haven't asked before? Why is this the largest survey ever and the first one?
I think it's important to focus that 40,000 teachers is a huge sample, and reading the survey, it really accurately reflected the American opinion of teachers, and I think that it hasn't been done before now because it's a massive undertaking, and Gates and Scholastic working together were finally able to coordinate this effort to really sort of coalesce teachers' opinions into a single document.
Yeah, they basically finally had the money to afford what was an expensive survey. Kate DeSetti, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Asian and European markets are down. Futures are mixed at this hour. The Dow gets underway at 10,396. The S&P opens at 1,118. And the NASDAQ starts trading in about a half hour at 2,280. So who is the ideal teacher? You ask teachers what to do to improve education? Sure, you ask teachers, and there are some great ones out there. Who is the ideal, the best teacher you've ever had? Tell us why. Stephen in Manhattan posts, the best teacher was Mr. Hoffman, a technical electronics teacher at Lawrence High School on Long Island. While considered a vocational training program, I went on to study mechanical engineering at the Cooper Union, and I still knew more electronics entering than most electrical engineers did upon graduation,
wow,
including but not limited to how to build a radio from scratch.
I'm all in support of building radios.
Yes, indeed. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site your ideal teacher, thetakeaway.org. More on what teachers need to improve education coming up in a few minutes.
It was the largest ever survey of American teachers released yesterday by the Gates Foundation and the Scholastic Publishing Company. 40,000 teachers answered questions on how to fix schools and what they need to do a better job. Kate DeSetti joins us again. She teaches English in a high school in Fresno, California, and she was also one of the teachers that gave a final read to the survey before it was released. And Kate, what stands out for you? What were the main messages from these teachers that were surveyed?
I think some of the things that stand out for me is that teachers really want rigorous common standards for their students so that they can ensure equity and access for all students. And I also think what stands out for me is that there were some really big issues that people tend to view teachers as being divided on. And they really show that we have a consensus opinion, and that despite the variety and breadth of the United States, there are some really strong, specific things that can be done to fix education.
Like?
I think that creating relevant curriculum, really rigorous, relevant curriculum. I think that supporting teachers as human beings within the community, within the school. You know, I think everyone wants to talk about the merit pay portion of the survey and the fact that it didn't rate higher among teachers, or even just pay in general, higher pay, you know, to retain teachers didn't rate higher in general. And I think it just shows that teachers are realistic about the resources that a school has, and that its human resources are its most valuable. And so really building supportive schools that are centered around children and centered around the community are really some of the key things to improving education.
Okay, well, let's bring in Jane Hannaway to this discussion. She's the director of the Education Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Jane, you've read this survey, and I'm wondering, are there things in there that we have not heard before, maybe some new solutions to problems in the educational system?
Yes, I think there are. One thing that I found both interesting and surprising and hopeful is the extent to which teachers were putting a high value on getting feedback, getting information called formative assessment about how well their students were doing. And I think education is one of the few industries, I think, in the country in which we haven't seen the returns to the returns from technology and the returns from data. And now it is moving into an information age, and teachers are finding it very useful to be getting this continuous feedback on how their students are doing in order to guide their instruction.
Well, you know, Jane, one of the difficulties for teachers is that there is no universal definition of what is a good teacher. There's no measure to say this is a good teacher and this is a struggling teacher. I mean, right? We don't have a universal definition of that.
We do and we don't. We have, I think, a partial definition of it. We do research. I'm a researcher on effective teaching, and what we look at is changes, improvements in students' test scores. Now, that's controversial in some circles because teachers do a lot more than just focus on whatever is in the test. But it is an important indicator of how well they're performing. And there's huge variation across teachers in the extent to which they produce these achievement gains among their students.
Okay, that's Jane Hannaway. She's a researcher, as she said, from the Education Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Let's go now to Andrew Parsons. He teaches kindergarten in a charter school in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew, you're actually in your classroom now, right?
Yep, I'm setting up for the day.
Okay, so you just heard what Jane said about trying to measure what makes a good teacher. But we don't really know that. We can't really predict who will be a good teacher and who will not.
No, I mean, it is very difficult to determine what's going to be a good teacher. I mean, as far as I've seen, the person that's going to be an expert at anything is the person that's really all and out willing to get the most information on everything they can about a subject. I think teaching is so complex and nuanced, much more than most people give it credit for being, any really good teacher is going to be one that is trying to get as much information as possible, which is why I think in the survey, which the results as a teacher I see is really dead on, the supportive leadership and innovation is one of those keys, because often I find teachers who are working really hard to get as much information as possible and get exposed to as many different models of teaching and get as much feedback on their own teaching as possible in environments where they don't have that readily available. And if a supportive leadership can build up an environment where everyone is really reflecting and looking at different models and looking at their own student work and understanding different measures like test scores, but also analyzing student work on a more qualitative level, then you're building up that knowledge base.
But Andrew, I thought that one of the main forces in the No Child Left Behind law was to get more personal development, more training for teachers.
I mean, that's an also difficult thing to say, because you can give an hour professional development on just how to give a standardized test, which is a reality in education and important to know how to do, you know, in a very, you know, equal way across classrooms. But, you know, you need more than just that. You need to be able to understand the fact that there are different measures beyond standardized tests, which was another finding in this poll that I think was also really important.
Well, this is
No Child Left Behind tended to focus on professional development as test prep.
Okay, well, this is a survey that obviously that the Obama administration is looking at closely as they look into how to fix America's schools. Andrew Parsons teaches kindergarten at a charter school in Brooklyn, New York. And Jane Hannaway, we spoke to, is the director of the Education Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Also, thanks to Kate DeSetti. She's been teaching for 10 years. She teaches high school English in Fresno, California. Thanks to all three of you. John, you said
it's
you
one
had
of these
a
things
favorite
you know team. It when you see it. A good teacher, you know it when you see it. Mrs. Compo, fourth grade.
What?
Class. Mrs. Cullen
fourth
in high
grade,
school.
Fourth grade, really?
Fabulous. Mr. Ellis, who died after I left high school, but incredible teacher.
I had so many. It's hard for me even to list them out. I mean, my teachers, when I look back, I really can see my teachers as kind of the barrier that's the strong standing between me and tragedy almost. I mean, so many times they threw themselves bodily between me and disaster.
My 11-year-olds, Mr. Nakel. They go crazy for Mr. Nakel.
Well, and we're asking listeners, I bet they can list their teachers, and that's what we're asking you to do. Who's your favorite teacher who made a difference for you? 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines. This morning, Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak tells ABC News he will not vote for President Obama's revised health care proposal. He says the bill would amount to the federal government directly subsidizing abortions. He says about a dozen other Democrats will also reject the plan on those grounds. Yesterday, the president unveiled his latest thinking.
It incorporates the best ideas from Democrats and Republicans, including some of the ideas that Republicans offered during the health care summit, like funding state grants on medical malpractice reform and curbing waste and fraud and abuse in the healthcare system.
But Republicans are still adamantly against the president's plans. The world's largest Baptist school, Baylor University in Texas, has received the largest donation in its history, an anonymous gift worth $200 million. The university made news last month when it hired Kenneth Starr as the school's new president. And finally, from Southern Baptist to a story about French Catholics, reports say this morning, Catholics in France who are too busy to go to church can now dial in their confession. The telephone hotline called Cord to the Lord allows people to reveal their sins to an answering machine. Hopefully the list of transgressions isn't too long, because the calls cost between 20 and 50 cents per minute. But if you've got something to confess, you want to save some cash, you can call us for free. Free! It's a bargain! 8778-MY-TAKE. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, the people in Chile aren't the only ones that are scarred by the recent quake. We're going to talk to one Chilean stuck in the United States, watching the disaster from afar and worrying about her home. That's in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
We begin with that earthquake in Chile last Saturday, 8.8 magnitude. On some level, in some sense, it shook the entire planet. We've been reporting on the details of the recovery and rescue effort inside Chile, the people closest to the tragedy and the closest to the coast where the tsunami was. But we've been also trying to get a handle on this notion of out of nowhere, a disaster, a natural event like this changes everything. And for that perspective, we go to Pierina Benvenuto, who's a Chilean architect visiting friends in Chicago. She was in Chicago presumably wondering about her own home when the earthquake hit last Saturday. Purina, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Now, I'm interested in your perspective both as an architect and also as somebody who is really helpless but safe in Chicago. What's been going through your mind the last few days?
Well, it's been hard since Saturday. Well, since 3 in the morning when my dad called here to tell there was an earthquake there, which is like the big one we were expecting for a long time. So it's been hard, but I've been lucky, so I've been able to talk to most of my family there. I know they're okay, but it's kind of weird to be missing the big one.
Well, I can barely imagine. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about architecture on this program, imagining the earthquake resistance. But for someone whose home is in the balance, what goes through your mind?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was there in the 1985 earthquake, and I saw most of my neighborhood go to the ground, basically, when I was a kid. So when they say earthquake, you don't know what you are expecting, you know? You know, maybe your house is standing, but maybe there's going to come an aftershock and it's going to fall, so.
And do you know the condition of your home?
Well, yesterday there were some structural specialists going to visit, so they say it will keep standing. So now I'm trying to make a project to fix it. Why I'm here, because I actually cannot go back. There's no flights back from here yet.
And so you're really helpless to the kinds of things like, listen to this. Here's a jackhammer in the town of Concepcion where authorities are already making decisions about buildings that are presumably abandoned. Are you worried that your home may be destroyed or demolished because of a decision far, far away from you?
No, it's not. No, I already talked to some architects and some engineers, and there's ways to fix it. I mean, they don't know why it's still standing, because it's like 100 years old.
Wow.
In downtown Santiago. But I've been lucky, as I said, and everyone is fine.
And your family is fine. Well, we're certainly grateful for that. Anything about your home when you heard it was an 8.8 magnitude quake that you said to yourself, uh-oh, that's going to be bad, or I'm glad I have that in my house. I'm sure I'll be safe.
It was full of uh-ohs.
A lot of uh-ohs, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, we certainly hope you make it back to Chile as soon as possible. And when you get there, your family and friends can have a reunion in your home, presuming it's still standing. Purina Benvenuto, a Chilean architect visiting friends in Chicago when the earthquake hit. We'll see you at O'Hare Airport there, Purina.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much for all your thoughts and all the information you're giving everyone here.
Our pleasure.
Let's turn now to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, spring training just started. Are we talking about steroids already? Really? The real baseball season hasn't begun. When are we going to leave steroids behind?
Last year there was a cloud over baseball because there was allegations and actually admissions of some of the stars of baseball, including Alex Rodriguez of the Yankees,
right,
that he had actually used steroids in previous years. Now that cloud has sort of descended again, and federal investigators are investigating a Canadian doctor. His name is Tony Galea, and he was arrested on drug charges in October, and he's at the center of this new steroid scandal because he allegedly transported drugs, HGH, human growth hormone, across
his assistant
country
was
lines.
Was captured at the border with these drugs on him, allegedly.
Correct.
And this doctor was treating some nationally known athletes?
He was treating some of the Tiger Woods is one of them. He's treating Carlos Beltran of the Mets, Jose Reyes. He has a therapy called plasma therapy. It's like this blood spinning where they take blood out and they put it in a centrifuge and they inject it back into the injured area. It's a very controversial procedure. And athletes, there's like a lot of mystique around him and this therapy, and athletes like this guy, apparently, so they've been going to him to sort of get this therapy and get his support for their injuries.
So they've questioned the Mets shortstop Jose Reyes, and what did he have to say?
Jose Reyes and Carlos Beltran said that they had never been approached by him to use human growth hormone. And I think the key thing here is that these are allegations, and the athletes, all the athletes involved in these conversations with federal officials have nothing to hide, presumably up front. And they've all basically been very upfront about what their communication was with Galea, what treatments they underwent with him. And in the case of Jose Reyes, his controversial procedure didn't really work out. He wasn't really on the field much last year anyway.
Well, I don't want to offend the whole nation by turning this into a Yankees discussion, but is the air cleared at all by the apparently squeaky clean championship of the Teixeira, the Derek Jeter, New York Yankees at all as spring training gets underway?
It definitely brings that cloud again over the Yankees and again over Alex Rodriguez. He has yet to finally meet with the federal officials to go through what his contact was and what he knew about Tony Galea. And so I think that until then, yes, that cloud has descended over. We thought it had cleared. We thought the weather had cleared from the steroid scandal. And then the Mark McGwire thing popped up again last year. Then the clouds went away, but now the clouds are back. And I would say the Yankees themselves have distanced themselves from this doctor and Alex Rodriguez meeting with him, just to be clear.
Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We have kind of a happier story that we're kind of focusing and asking listeners about. Ibrahim, did you have a teacher that made a difference for you?
Her name is now Miss Jacobus, but she, at the time, she was my English teacher, and she made us diagram sentences for a year.
I don't remember. That stuck with you, diagramming sentences?
I don't remember anything else but diagramming sentences.
That was
and
a positive
she was
impact.
Great because she got you to do that, or?
Yes, she was brilliant. She was brilliant. I mean, she was the best teacher, one of the best teachers I've ever had.
Let us know who your favorite teacher was that had the biggest impact on you at 8778MYTAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the standards for how when someone is below the poverty line haven't been changed for decades, but they recalculated them to take into account medical expenses and a few other things. And it turns out that when they did that, 20% of the elderly in the United States were poor. They were below the poverty line. We're going to find out what's happened in a few moments. First, let's take a check on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. There's political blowback this morning against President Obama's plan to push forward with health care reform. Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak and 11 other Democrats are threatening not to vote for the bill. Stupak represents less than 100,000 people in northern Michigan. He tells ABC News this morning.
Look, give us our language. Let's keep current law. No public funding for abortion. Let's pass health care.
But Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius tells NBC News.
This bill does not change the status quo on abortion. That's what the president has pledged all along. This isn't about an abortion debate. It's about health reform.
To pass the health care bill, the House has to adopt the Senate version of the bill. Moving now to Iraq, where police officials say 16 people have been killed in suicide bombings in Baghdad this morning. This comes as early voting began today ahead of Sunday's nationwide parliamentary election. Here at home, the American Cancer Society now has new guidelines for prostate cancer screenings. Dr. Gerardo Brooks, the group's director of prostate cancer, says,
we encourage that men get educated about the possible benefits and the known harms and risk, and then make a decision.
The guideline does not recommend routine screenings because they might do more harm than good. Taking a look at the markets, markets are up slightly. The Dow's up 25 points. The S&P is up 2. NASDAQ is up 3. And this morning's report on new jobless claims shows layoffs may be easing off a bit. Initial claims fell by 29,000. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So as we often say on this program, there's doing it by the numbers, and then there's sort of figuring out what the humanitarian issues are in our analysis of the economy each day. You may or may not know that the government, the federal government, has been using the same formula to calculate poverty rates since 1955. Many people think it's outdated. Maybe it is. But the government is on a way to implementing a brand new formula for calculating poverty rates, and it may have an impact, an unintended impact, on the elderly. More than 7 million folks over the age of 65 may fall under the poverty line if this recalculation goes through. And Dolores Miller, who we welcome back to the program here in New York City. Good morning, Dolores.
Yes, good morning.
Now, these recalculations, all this sort of changing of the numbers increases your worry and your struggles in your own home, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Describe your situation right now for us, if you could.
Yes, well, I'm a GLBT senior, and I am a lesbian. It's still difficult for me to be out, but anyway, I am.
Well,
and
go for it there, Dolores. You're out now.
I certainly am. And I find myself in a situation, because I don't have too many coins, and I find myself in a situation, well, the landlord's been trying to get me out of my apartment, and it was in the court system. the case for 2.5 years, and he was trying to get me out on succession rights.
That means that because your partner is...
She passed away.
Right, she passed away, and she's a same-sex partner as opposed to your spouse.
Yes.
The landlord can actually evict you from the home.
Yes, our laws, our city, our state, our government, the laws do not protect us.
Does it surprise you, and you're how old?
I'm 74, almost 75.
Does it surprise you that the federal government might jigger with the calculation for poverty and you would end up being, on top of everything else, poor as well?
Well, I don't really feel I need to hear the calculations. I'm quite aware of it because of things that are happening to me. And when you find it's difficult to make ends meet, well, yes, they do need figuring out. I think they need a much closer look at these calculations. Yes.
Dolores Miller, the clock is ticking here. When are you out of your apartment?
I'm scheduled to be evicted next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. Sam Roberts is New York Times urban affairs correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, of course. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, John.
How does this recalculation and all these sort of administrative details sort of illustrate the notion that you've covered, that seniors are really struggling in this economic environment right now?
Well, as Dolores said, you don't need the government to tell you when you're poor or not. But one of the things about this new calculation, and it's inspired in large part by the Bloomberg administration's adoption of it a couple of years ago, is that it will give us a better idea of who is officially poor. As the mayor says, as Pat Moynihan used to say, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. Unfortunately, the government has no intention of changing the official poverty line, the one that is, as you say, based on figures that are 40 or 50 years old, but this will give a much better idea of who is actually poor, realistically poor. It will deduct things from the threshold, like food stamps, like tax credits. It will add things to the threshold, like commuting costs, daycare, out-of-pocket medical expenses, a particular burden for the elderly.
Okay, so Sam, let me stop you there. Does that mean that people like Dolores Miller are then going to be eligible for all kinds of services that are going to help them out?
Unfortunately not, because eligibility and funding for the states will not change on the basis of that, at least not officially, because there'll be winners and losers, and politicians in Washington don't like to acknowledge that.
So you've got an eviction next Wednesday, Dolores Miller.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're just basically caught in the middle. You're just a number here in the middle.
I'm just a number in the middle, and I am terrified. Terrifying. And I'm a pretty strong person, but regarding others in the same scenario who are, shall we say, not quite as strong, perhaps frail in mind or body or spirit, God help them.
And you know people like that, right?
Oh, yes.
Sure. And what about your family? Are they a backstop?
I have no family. I have a cousin in Vermont who's rather frail himself, and so I really have to. I mean, I do have family, my cousin, of course, but I have no other family.
Sam Roberts, what are the numbers here? How many? We said perhaps 20 million people, but how many people are possibly in Dolores' situation, facing these kinds of deadlines, without a clear address to take her concerns?
Well, a lot of people, and a lot more than we would ordinarily think. Of course, measuring poverty is a very subjective judgment, but if you look at the numbers nationally, by one estimate, more than half of all Americans will be below the poverty threshold at least a year during their lives. And if we apply this new measure, which is a much more realistic and relevant measure, the number of people in poverty is likely to go up in specific categories, particularly the elderly, because they've got those out of pocket medical
right.
expenses, and also the working poor.
So, Dolores Miller, before we go, 2, 3, 4 years ago, things were looking pretty good, eh?
Well, not really. My partner passed away, so things were not looking too good.
But did you expect you would be in this situation sort of at the end of the day, end of the line?
No, I did not. I never expected my country to take away my home. I thought it happened in other countries. I thought I never, and I had a good case.
Dolores, we're going to put the takeaway on this case. Dolores Miller, you sit tight. Good luck to you between now and next Wednesday. Sam Roberts, New York Times Urban Affairs correspondent, thanks so much for helping us out with this.
Thank you.
Coming up in a moment, it's been 30 years since Robert Mugabe became the leader of Zimbabwe.
the phase of independence should be regarded as a phase conferring upon all of us full democratic rights.
The journey for Mugabe from hero, liberator, to, some would say, tyrant, autocrat. That's coming up later this hour. And on our website, we have a bunch of extras for you. Who was your favorite teacher to our cat show? You've been sending us your feline photos for the Takeaway Cat Show, and now's the time to vote. The polls are open until 2 p.m. Eastern. We'll be announcing the winner on air tomorrow. Go to vote at our site, thetakeaway.org. Lots of people doing all kinds of things in order to get jobs, especially with the unemployment rate as high as it is. And you know, we've asked many times on this, the Takeaway, what would you do to get a job and what do you need to do? Well, how about changing your name?
My name?
Yeah, would you change your name to get a job?
You know, it's worked pretty well for me so far. I mean, if it came down to
that. Well, you're employed. If you were unemployed, right, you might change your name. Well, Topeka, Kansas is changing their name. They will not be Topeka, Kansas.
You're kidding me.
They will be Google, Kansas. My next guest is Bill Bunton. He's the mayor of the town formerly known as Topeka. Yesterday, he signed a proclamation that officially changes his town's name to Google, Kansas, the capital city of fiber optics.
This is a hoax.
No, it's not a hoax. Bill, this is not a hoax.
Oh, no, it's not a hoax, Celeste.
This is temporary, though, right?
Oh, yes. We'd have to change our charter ordinance to change the name permanently, but we're having a lot of fun with it.
Well, you're changing your name, and why are you doing that?
We were contacted by Google as a possible site for testing new technology that they have that accesses information on the Internet at about 100 times faster than we do it now. We were interested in that and are going to make an application. Young people here in Topeka got interested in it, and they created a website where people can sign up and show that they're supportive of trying to get Google to use Topeka as their test site. And last time I heard, it was around 12,000 people who had signed up.
On
and
Facebook.
One of those young people suggested that we change the name for a day. And it sounded like fun, so our city council and I got together and approved it, and we've changed the name from Topeka to Google Kansas.
Bill Punton, you are one for the books.
For the month of March.
It's like a Stephen Colbert approach to getting jobs.
How far are you going with this? Are you putting post-it notes over the name Topeka and all your official correspondence? Are you marking them out with whiteout just for that month?
Well, we haven't done that, but I will tell you that others are joining in. I learned last night that our semi-pro baseball team, the Golden Giants, is now the Google Golden Giants.
Nice.
Some businesses are doing the same thing. So we're having a good time with it, and we hope that the people at Google have a sense of humor.
Have you heard back from Google?
No, I haven't. And I don't expect to. They don't want to show any kind of favoritism at this point and discourage other cities from
Bill Bunton, make me an argument. What can you test in Topeka that gives you a better test than, say, you know,
Poughkeepsie,
Elkhart, Indiana, or Poughkeepsie?
Oh, well, we're the capital city of Kansas, and we have a 6,000 student university here. We have a state-of-the-art library, a new, fairly new performing arts center. Just all sorts of things. This is a wonderful city.
And you have a whole populace willing to change the name from Topeka to Google. That to me is kind of a strong argument there, Bill Bunton.
Mayor
of Google, Kansas now. In about a month, he'll go back to being mayor of Topeka, Kansas. Thanks so much for joining us. Good morning. Coming up in a moment, it's been 30 years since Robert Mugabe became Zimbabwe's first black leader. We're going to talk about the arc of his leadership. Many people now, of course, see him as a tyrant. That's in a few minutes. We've also been talking this morning about the new survey of more than 40,000 teachers asking what they need in order to improve education. You can find out more about that survey on our website, thetakeaway.org. But it got us thinking about great teachers, what they've done for us and how they've influenced them. We've asked you, who's your best teacher?
Hello, my name is Chad Johnson from Royal Oak, Michigan. I'd have to say my most influential teacher and best teacher was Russell Garland, where I grew up in Castleton, North Dakota. and he was physics and mathematics and science and chemistry. He spoke a million miles an hour and was very passionate and prepared me for a career in engineering like no one else.
Good morning, guys. This is Hector calling from New York. My favorite teacher, without a doubt, was Miss Milson. This was in the fifth grade, and I remember the breaking down words grammatically and doing subject predicate. To this day, I do that in my head.
Lots of people influenced by grammatical plotting. Give us the story of your best teacher at 8778-MYTAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I want to take this moment to thank Mr. Greco, my AP U.S. history teacher. But first, let's check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In the economy, the latest report on new jobless claims indicates that layoffs may be easing. The government says initial claims fell by 29,000 last week. Staying with employment, a jobs bill is expected to win House approval today. It includes tax breaks for companies that hire unemployed workers. Going to Chile now, where the military has stepped up efforts to deliver aid to survivors in Concepcion. That's a city hit hard by Saturday's earthquake. And an amazing network of caves that apparently was used by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda has been discovered in Pakistan. The caves were dug into the Rocky Mountains close to the Afghan border, and they'd been used so recently they still had bedding and other items inside. To get the details, we spoke with the BBC's Shoaib Hassan. He joined us from Islamabad earlier today, and he told us what they'd found inside the caves.
Well, they found bedding, they found clothes from the Taliban fighters. I think they found some weapons as well, although the army didn't display that to the journalists who were taken over there. But they found a lot of odds and ends. But basically, they found a lot of caverns and caves that were in use by the Taliban as late as a few days ago. These caves were captured on Tuesday, the 2nd of March, by the Pakistan Army in an ongoing operation against the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda in the Bajor tribal region. That's right next to the border with Afghanistan.
We've heard a lot about some top Taliban and Al-Qaeda officials that have been captured by Pakistan. Could these caves have been discovered because of information they gleaned from captured officials?
Well, not really. I mean, the existence of the caves themselves was known to the officials for several years, but this is the first time that journalists and, I think, army officials were actually able to get inside. The militants had dug in an enormous series of interconnected tunnels to connect these caves and to use them as bunkers, as fortified bunkers, as places to for rest and recuperation while fighting the Pakistan army along the border with Afghanistan, and especially in this region, which is quite important in the current scenario as the United States gears up to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Okay, that's Shoaib Hassan. He's a correspondent for our partner, the BBC, in Islamabad. We actually have video of those Al-Qaeda caves on our website at thetakeaway.org. And those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
A moment of hope. 30 years ago today. Joining us now from the studios of WGBH in Boston, our partner station in Boston, Andy Abrams is a senior editor at Global Post, and Brighton Mudzingwa is born and raised in Zimbabwe, has lived under Robert Mugabe his whole life. First of all, good morning to both of you.
Morning.
And the milestone that we are commemorating and noting this morning is 30 years ago this happened.
The parade ground at Foxtrot Camp, just before the election results came through. The guerrillas sensed victory, but they promised to go along with the results even if they lost.
When the official announcement was finally made, they went wild. Throughout the day, they'd been singing and dancing and chanting and running through the streets of Seoul.
The official end, 30 years ago today, of British-owned Rhodesia and the ascension of Zimbabwe, and particularly the first Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, who was elected at a time of hope in what was then called Rhodesia, a nation not unlike South Africa in certain ways, who looked to be ahead of the political changes going on in Africa. Andy Melderman, didn't turn out that way.
No, there was great optimism in the early years of Mugabe's rule, and Mugabe did fulfill that. There was peace in the country, the education, health for the majority of Zimbabweans, the black Zimbabweans, improved dramatically. But within a few years, it became clear that Robert Mugabe was going to rule as an autocratic ruler and that he would broach no criticism of his rule.
Brighton Mudzingwa, you grew up under Mugabe your entire life in Zimbabwe. What was his reputation as you were a young child learning about him from your parents?
Yeah, certainly there was a great level of optimism for many people, a sense of admiration across different sections of society. Unfortunately, as time went by, we began to see that optimism fade because people were getting disillusioned with the state of the economy.
Here's a speech Robert Mugabe gave on the day he was elected prime minister, really promising that any worries that people had about the future, they should dispel, that it was the beginning of a new era.
And those who have talked about the possibility of some people being victimized, possibility of personal and other properties being nationalized, being seized, well, have not read us correctly. We will not do any such thing.
Speech on March 4th, 1980 in Zimbabwe. Virtually every one of those promises was violated. Andy Meldrum, can you explain how?
Well, it took some time, right? What Robert Mugabe was doing was preventing a flee, a mass exodus of white Zimbabweans and of other middle-class people from the country. And he achieved that. But then 20 years later, when his rule was being threatened, then Robert Mugabe decided that he was going to seize white-owned farms and that he was going to make life more difficult for the white minority.
Was there a turning point, Andy Meldrum?
Well, I'd say the turning point came in the year 2000 when voters, and this was the majority of Zimbabweans, rejected the constitution that Robert Mugabe had drafted, which would have given him increased executive powers. And when that was rejected, he was furious, and he blamed the white farmers for that defeat, and he sent his war vets in to start seizing their properties.
But the seeds of this unrest and this internecine quarreling that became the economic catastrophe that we see today, Brighton Mudzingwa, was really clear a year before you were born, right? The 20,000 people were massacred in 1985, the year before you were born. What did you hear about that massacre?
Well, that is certainly a very sad phase of our country's history. And I think even up until now, there's still many unanswered questions for many in Zimbabwean society. And so in terms of closure, there certainly isn't much closure. And there's still many unanswered questions that people hope one day will be answered.
Andy Meldrum, a senior editor at Global Post, you know, people ask all the time, how is it that Mugabe is able to hold on to power? But maybe the better question is, why does he?
Well, that why is, power, he follows an old African model, which is the best ruler is the longest ruler. And so he is determined to hang on and hang on longer than Nelson Mandela or many other, Julius Nyerere, others of the he wants to be seen in Africa as the greatest liberation leader of the continent, and he is going to be in power the longest. That's what he believes, and he doesn't care what the cost is to the country, to the economy, to the people of Zimbabwe.
Well, it's a sort of a terrifying sort of look 30 years back to what could have been such a heroic paradise in Zimbabwe. Andy Meldrum, senior editor at Global Post, worked in Zimbabwe as a journalist for 23 years from 1980 till 2003, and Brighton Mudzingwa, born and raised in Zimbabwe, has lived under Mugabe his whole life. Robert Mugabe, still the president of Zimbabwe.
I am the president of the Republic of Zimbabwe. That is the reality everybody has to accept first and foremost if they want dialogue with us.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. 30 years ago today, this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.